America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Our 26 years of conservative war and economic policies. And, you know, I'm reluctant to even call it conservative, because I know that there are a lot of good people out there who call themselves conservatives who don't agree with this stuff, but I lack a better word. Our 26 years of these policies leading to the destruction of democracy around the world. The exact opposite of what we've been claiming and holding up as the American ideal all these, these many centuries now. I mean, for example, we have a president right now, George W. Bush. He just held a news conference. And before I play this clip, let me just point out to you, number one, Nelson Mandela, the man who spent all those years in prison in South Africa protesting apartheid, who became one of the moral leaders of the world, I believe winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. I don't have his CV in front of me. Just an extraordinary, is still alive. He's still around. And in fact, one of his more recent comments, this was in 2002, the fall of 2002, Nelson Mandela was asked about Bush's ramping up for the war in Iraq, and he said that George Bush is a man who can't think properly and wants to plunge the world into a Holocaust. He went on to say, this is Nelson Mandela. He went on to say, why does the United States behave so arrogantly? They must just want the oil. We must expose this as much as possible. So that's what Nelson Mandela had to say about us and about George W. Bush. Nelson Mandela, who's still alive, still around, still functioning, a great man. This is what George Bush had to say today.
I thought an interesting comment was made when somebody said to me, I heard somebody say, now where's Mandela? Well, Mandela's dead because Saddam Hussein killed all the Mandelas.
So Saddam, I mean, when Nelson Mandela said 4 years ago that George Bush was a man who can't think properly, I think he was, if not accurate at the time, certainly prescient. Saddam Hussein killed all the Mandelas. I mean, this. And again, I, one of the things I try to avoid on this program, I just, you know, lay it right out for you. One of the things I try to avoid is doing basically what I call complaint radio. They're not doing that right. They're not doing this right. He's a bad guy. I frankly don't think it goes anywhere. I think it's far more useful to raise an issue, highlight that issue, you know, help all of us gain a better understanding of it, and then know what to do about it, rather than just sitting around and complaining. And so I want to put this in that context that, you know, okay, here's George Bush, and he blows it again. I mean, you know, he says Mandela's dead, and then he tries to blame it on Saddam. At the same time, and here's the larger frame, and this is what I want to bring it back to, is are we, has the behavior of the United States, and frankly, not just during the Bush administration, I mean, I saw this, I was very concerned about the invasion of Grenada, for example. I've been to Grenada. It's a nice little place, you know, it's a nice little island. There's a great little place where they serve incredible rum drinks called the Nutmeg Cafe right there on the ocean. I had a few too many of them there, in fact, Louise and I. But the point is, you know, when Reagan invaded Grenada, I'm like, wait a minute. This is, you know, Bush Sr. going after Noriega. I mean, what are we, the world's cops now? This is not how you bring about democracy. So there are a number of troubling issues that I think in aggregate, when you look at all of them together, really must force us to ask the question, with or without President Bush's relatively incoherent commentary, to ask the question, our 26 years, you know, ever since the election of Ronald Reagan, and this hard swing to the right that happened in the United States, both economically and internationally. It was basically, that was the end of the New Deal. You know, the New Deal that, that built the American middle class, the largest middle class America has ever seen. Franklin Roosevelt, starting in the 1930s, built this amazing, extraordinary middle class that got so strong in the 60s and 70s, so healthy economically, such a healthy and vibrant democracy that people felt free to go out in the streets and protest, that people felt free, minorities felt free to speak up and demand the rights that they had been promised. That strong and healthy and vibrant democracy and middle class has been under assault for 26 years, ever since Reagan was elected, and essentially the New Deal came to an end, and we entered an era of something that doesn't yet have a name. The Europeans refer to it as neoliberalism, but there's not a consensus word in the United States. I call it conservative economic policies, knowing that there's a limit to that. When Limbaugh comes along and says,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
He's absolutely right. One of Roosevelt's policies, for example, was that in World War II, Franklin Roosevelt said, I do not want there to be one millionaire made as a result of this war. For example. So what has happened under the Bush administration? Well, keep in mind, Roosevelt believed in government. He believed that government was we the people collectively working together for our own collective benefit and ultimately for the benefit of the world. For the benefit of the biosphere, for the benefit of all humankind. The ideals on which this country was founded. Franklin Roosevelt believed in, as did Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican Roosevelt, believed in those things. But the Republicans, starting with Ronald Reagan, who reinstalled the imperial presidency. You'll recall Jimmy Carter walked to his inauguration. Reagan went in a limousine. Jimmy Carter had a very subdued inaugural ball. Reagan had something worthy of a king. I mean, it was a coronation. There was this major shift. Carter called on us to work together to become independent of oil. He wanted us to have, by the year 2000, 20% of all the electricity in the United States produced, all the energy, actually, in the United States produced by solar power, and put us on the course to do that, and promised that actually put into place legislation, later it was taken down by the Republicans and Reagan, but that would, he said, we will never again import more oil into the United States than we did in 1978. I mean, we were going down the right road. And Reagan just took it off the cliff. And for 26 years, we've been going down this wrong road. And the question, you know, are 26 years of conservative war and economic policy leading to the destruction of democracy? I think the answer around the world, I think the answer is yes. What do we do about it? Well, let's start, first of all, by looking at war as a net negative, not a net positive. For example, over at moneycentral.msn.com, one of the investing articles, Michael Bruce writing, CEOs of top defense contractors have reaped annual pay gains of 200 to 688% since 9/11. The CEOs of the defense contractors like General Dynamics, Halliburton, Oshkosh Trucks have made on average more in 4 days than what a top general makes in a whole year. Nicholas Shabdra, is the CEO of General Dynamics, between 2002 and 2006, pocketed $97.9 million, or an average of $19.6 million a year. Their sales went up 76% from 2002 to 2006, in large part because of Department of Defense spending. Their stock went from $39 to $80. David Lazar at Halliburton made $79.8 million, $16 million a year during that same period of time, from the beginning of the Iraq War until today. The Department of Defense revenue for his company went from 4% in 2001 to 40% in 2004. And he puts the money in his pocket. Halliburton stock was $5 when Dick Cheney became vice president. It's 40 now, or it was last year. You know, Lockheed Martin, chief executives Vance Kaufman and Robert Stevens together earned $64.8 million during that same period of time, 2002 to 2006. We are creating war millionaires, number one. Number two, one of the hottest and fastest growing industries in the United States is now helping China suppress democracy. And number three, it looks now that we have killed more civilians in Iraq than Saddam Hussein ever did.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
So in Istanbul, the World Tribunal on Iraq has accused the United States of causing more deaths in Iraq than did Saddam Hussein. They've held about 20 sessions in different locations around the world, pulling together these statistics. They've been doing this since 2003. This is a rather substantial indictment to the news story up at the top of Common Dreams. At the same time, Paul Bremer's Order 81, Nancy Scola, who, by the way, is the head blogger over at AirAmerica.com. Nancy Scola wrote a brilliant piece over at Alternet about how the explosion of farmer suicides in India, which has been going on for the last few years, in large part, in the opinion of many people, is a consequence of Indian farmers adopting genetically modified products, crops, and then not being able to save seeds like they've traditionally done, but having to buy the new seed every year or else face legal sanctions. That when they have a bad year, they can't afford to buy the seed for the next year. They can't get a loan from the bank, and the suicide rates in India are just going through the roof. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. And that, in fact, this so far at this year, at last count, this from Nancy Scola's piece, at last count, more than 1,000 farmers have killed themselves just in the state of Maharashtra. New York Times pinned it at 17,000 Indian farmers in 2003 alone committed suicide. PBS did a special about it called The Dying Fields. One farmer commits suicide in Verbana every 8 hours because they're buying these genetically modified seeds, and all of a sudden they're cut off from their tradition. Well, one of Paul Bremer's orders, Order 81, in Iraq that changed the laws of Iraq, essentially set up Iraq for the same thing. In the meantime, Tom Hayden, blogging over at the Huffington Post, or writing over at the Huffington Post, goes into quite a bit of detail, reveals. I mean, he goes into this extraordinary September 7th, 2007 report put together by Marine General James Jones and a panel of 30 top military experts that most people have largely ignored, which says that the police of Iraq, the Ministry of Interior is a ministry in name only. I'm quoting from Chapter 7 of the report. The Ministry of Interior of Iraq is a ministry in name only. It is widely regarded as being dysfunctional and sectarian. Chapter 8, talking about the Iraqi police service, they say the police are directly involved in the Shia side in a complex civil war against the Sunnis. The police follow the model of an occupying army more than of community-based policing. Chapter 9, talking about the police in Iraq. Despite efforts to reform the Iraqi National Police, the organization remains a highly sectarian element of the security forces. The Iraqi National Police is almost exclusively Shia. In its current form, the National Police is not a viable organization and should be disbanded. Now, this is our military looking at this situation and saying, here's what's the situation. Corruption and external influence and infiltration are widespread, they say. They say the Ministry of Interior has become politicized. Jaber, who was the former head of it, gave key ministry posts to members of the Badr Brigade, and Badr Brigade militia infiltrated Iraqi police units in many areas of the country. The MOI is so dangerous that when Western officials visit the Ministry of Interior, they have to wear body armor and only come in on their heavily armed escort. In other words, the Ministry of Interior and the police departments, the civilian police departments in Iraq, have become the thugs that everybody's afraid of. There is no, this is, you can't have democracy in this kind of a situation. The General Accountability Office, by the way, came to the same conclusion in September. They said the government has not eliminated militia control of local security, eliminated political intervention in military operations, or ensured even-handed enforcement of the law. So we have not brought democracy to Iraq. In fact, you know, Bush says, well, we'll stand up as they stand down. Problem is, what's standing up? As Tom Hayden points out, a police state. Meanwhile, in the Senate, Democrats and some Republicans of good conscience have a majority of votes to say, okay, let's get us out of the way anyway and let these guys sort this stuff out themselves. No. Republicans loyal to Bush, not going to allow it to happen. And then on top of this, and this is where what I'm pulling this, I'm trying to pull this whole thing together to point out that this governing philosophy that came in with Reagan, that everything should be turned over to free markets, which is what happened in Iraq. This is what Bremer's 100 Orders were all about, was creating a libertarian paradise in Iraq, that turning everything over to free markets, that doing away with the idea of government and governance has been, for 26 years, a disaster. The disempowering labor, all these things that have been done under the name of conservatism have destroyed America and, or destroyed much of America's middle class, and they're destroying democracy all around the world. The hottest new stock, one of the hottest new stocks now, is a company that manufactures for the Chinese government, for their surveillance industry, hardware and software that's used to crack down on dissidents. There's an amazing, Harold Myerson writing an amazing piece in the Washington Post about this. He says there's this an industry our hedge fund gurus believe has an almost limitless future, the Chinese police state. One of our largest hedge funds is investing in this thing. They have, by one estimate, high-end surveillance will expand from a $500 million industry in 2003 to a $43 billion industry by 2010. CSST received over $110 million from Citadel Group, Chicago-based hedge fund. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Get away.
Hey, welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. The reason that I'm so concerned about this, frankly, is because history shows that no two truly democratic nations, nations where the people's will is being done by their elected leaders. And frankly, I would argue that since 2001, we have not fully been in that category because our president was appointed by our Supreme Court, not elected by our people. But that no two democratic nations have ever in the history of the world gone to war with each other. You want to have peace. You have democracy. But you can't shove democracy down people's throats with the barrel of a gun. You do it by being an example. Just like you can't shove human rights down people's throats with the barrel of a gun. You do it by being an example. And the example that we've been for the last 26 years, you know, with a brief exception of the Clinton years to some extent, but by and large, the example that we've been since Ronald Reagan declared the end of the New Deal and we began the Reagan era has been an example that has been anti-democratic. to the point now where we have American companies in China helping the Chinese crack down on their own people and suppress dissent. Oh, that's just fine. Rupert Murdoch censoring the news in China for his in exchange for his star satellite system service over there. Oh, just let's make some money. The new American ideal for the last 26 years has been money over everything. And frankly, money over democracy. And so I would submit to you that the this conservative model of governance, which has been so often discredited in the past, is once again being discredited in a variety of ways, particularly with regard to peace around the world and also with regard to economics. I want to talk about that a little more tomorrow and get into it next week. But, you know, I mean, right now, just it's startling what's going on. I mean, gold is over $723 an ounce, I think it is right now, or 730 maybe it's pushing. Oil is over $82 a barrel. I was just in Europe. It costs $5 to get a glass of water. China has just announced that they're putting price freezes in place. They're worried about inflation. The Saudis are talking about not dropping their interest rates along with us. This is a sign that perhaps they're going to decouple the Saudi riyal from the dollar. If they do that, well, there's been talk about, you know, a new Middle Eastern gold-based currency. If that happens, then the dollar could really go into free fall. There's a lot of people very, very concerned about this. The Canadian dollar is almost equal to a U.S. dollar right now. That is not, in my lifetime at least, that I've been paying attention to, that's not happened before. These are all indications that the conservative policies, first of all, their war policies and their civil rights policies and their humanitarian policies are destroying our reputation and harming democracy around the world and diminishing, frankly, the power of democracies and this and the vitality of democracy around the world. And therefore, we need to take it back. And secondly, that their economic policies are really throwing us in the hole. Dennis Caution writing over on USA Today, taxpayers on the hook for $59 trillion. That's $516,348 for every U.S. household. That's how much we owe. Now, it could be solved if we went back to the tax policies that we had under John Kennedy, for example, or under Richard Nixon. If we went back to Richard Nixon's income tax policies, and if we simply took the cap off Social Security, we could entirely solve that problem. And if we did away with the free trade agreements, we could do away with the current account deficit. That is this enormous debt that we're incurring with countries around the world with regard to trade. There are some relatively simple solutions to these problems, but they're solutions that are going to help the middle class. They're going to strengthen the average American, and they're going to hurt transnational corporations. And therefore, there's not a lot of politicians who are willing to talk about this stuff. And frankly, very few commentators and conservative columnists, they don't even want to bring up the topics. You've got a few people who are talking about these issues, very few people talking about these issues and how important they are. But I think it's critical stuff that we hold democracy as small d democracy as a very high value. And human rights and civil rights and habeas corpus and the rights of privacy and fiscal responsibility, and, you know, I mean, Ronald Reagan, George Bush Sr., and George Bush Jr. have run up more than 40% of all the debt that this country has run up in its entire history. Ronald Reagan borrowed more money than the money that George Washington borrowed to pay for the Revolutionary War, that James Madison borrowed to pay for the War of 1812, that Abraham Lincoln borrowed to pay for the Civil War, that Woodrow Wilson borrowed to pay for World War I, and Franklin Roosevelt borrowed to pay for World War II. Combined! He borrowed more money than all of them combined and spent it in ways that made millionaires and billionaires out of his buddies in the defense industry. And slightly stimulated the economy in the process. And what are we left with? A debt of $516,000 per family in the United States. And we wonder why the world is looking at the dollar going, we don't think your dollar is all that strong anymore. Why the world is really starting to get concerned. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. James in Maine, listening on WLVP. Hey, James, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? I don't know if I lost my train of thought here, but... this gets back to what you were discussing yesterday and just when you were coming on the show and playing that Bush clip.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that earlier, and I couldn't understand for the life of me what the heck he was talking about.
Well, you know, what he was trying to say, and we should probably give Bush some credit for this, what he was trying to say is that there are, you know, the question is, where are the people in Iraq who are standing up and taking the high moral ground the way Nelson Mandela did in South Africa? And Bush's comment, what Bush meant to say was Saddam Hussein killed them all off.
Yeah.
It's hyperbole. It's not true. The fact of the matter is that there are many statesmen and women in Iraq who would have come forward if when we finished our war in May of 2003 and we began the occupation, if we had helped them build the institutions of government. But the guys around Bush, you know, Feith, Pearl, Wolfowitz, Kachini, the Secretary of Defense, I mean, the whole bunch of them, they don't believe in government. They don't believe in Don Rumsfeld. They don't believe in the idea of there being government. They believe in the free market. And so Bremer went in and kicked the doors open and said, okay, it's all going to be free market, flat 15% tax, makes labor unions illegal. That's government interference in the marketplace, et cetera, et cetera. And it brought a living hell to Iraq. And that's what has caused the loss of the Mandelas in Iraq, frankly. So, you know, that's but, you know, your point well taken. Weldon in British Columbia, Canada. Hey, Weldon, what's on your mind today?
Well, I know you were talking yesterday about the free-falling American dollar and likening it to the German Deutschmark, you know, in pre-fascist Germany.
Yeah, in the early 20s.
And I'm just wondering, like, if you're paralleling these two, what is your solution?
Well, I think first of all, it's a very imperfect analogy because the dollar still is the world's reserve currency, and it's unlikely that the dollar is going to collapse massively. My guess is we're going to see the dollar, drop probably 5-10%, and then it'll stabilize. What that's going to mean, though, is that all Americans, relative to the rest of the world, are that much poorer. And we're that much poorer because, you know, we've had 26 years of insane economic policies of borrow and spend. We're in debt to the world. We've changed our trade policies so we no longer manufacture things here. So all the profits from manufacturing are going to companies overseas. You've got foreign companies coming into the United States and buying the few manufacturing facilities we still have left and taking the profits home because we have this huge external debt from the profits. But, you know, I'm not a Chicken Little here. I really don't think that we're going to see the next Great Depression. I think we're going to see a recession. But, what to do about it? I mean, you know, from an investment point of view, obviously, you know, invest in commodities, you know, things like gold and oil and whatnot, and get liquid and get out of debt as fast as you can, would be my opinion. In terms of, you know, what can be done internationally, we need to, in the United States, we need to be arguing for rational economic policies. What used to be the economic policies, frankly, of Barry Goldwater, you know, of let's have a balanced budget, let's pay as we go. You want to have a war, you raise taxes to pay for it. It's what Franklin Roosevelt did. It's what, you know, it's what Woodrow Wilson did. It's what, you know, the first time that we had an income tax in the United States was Abraham Lincoln. He placed a flat 1% income tax on everybody in the United States to pay for the Civil War. I mean, that's what you do. If you're going to have a war, you don't borrow from future generations to have it. And Bush is we're over $1 trillion now so far. And it looks like it's going to be many trillions of dollars if we're there for years and years and years.
So you don't consider the United States a rogue fascist state yet?
I would not go that far. I would say that the United States is behaving in ways that are illegal, that the Bush administration has behaved in ways that we have committed war crimes, that the preemptive attack against Iraq was clearly a war crime, and that there's a number of senior officials who probably should be in the dock at The Hague, where Slobodan Milosevic was. But as a nation, I think we still have our moral compass to a large extent, and I think it's coming back, and I think that that's one of the reasons in the 2006 elections you saw Democrats being elected, and frankly, I think it's one of the reasons why Congress only has an 11% approval rating, because the American people want Congress to stand up to these crazies and say, no, we're taking America back.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Yeah, have a nice day. In fact, let's call out somebody doing something right. John Conyers, Congressman John Conyers. I just got an email from him. I'm guessing probably many of you did. If you go over to his website at johnconyers.com, you can get on the list. He says, Dear Thomas, I wanted to take the opportunity to update you on the status of the contempt of Congress resolution in the House of Representatives. As you may know, the Judiciary Committee passed a resolution before the August recess holding the White House and Harriet Myers in contempt of Congress for their failure to provide documents and appear before the committee as legally required by subpoena. The information we've received to date from the Justice Department, from our U.S. attorneys, investigation indicates the White House played a central role in the firing of 9 federal prosecutors, yet the White House has stonewalled and consistently refused to cooperate with inquiries in this matter. And he goes on to say that it looks like this was politically motivated. They've also discovered that the job candidates' political contributions and affiliations were considered in hiring. This is all illegal. He said this cannot be this politicization of our judicial system cannot be tolerated. And there's many steps we can take in this confrontation. Some are more extreme than others. What we must first do is get the facts. And in order to do that, he says, what is now required is for the House of Representatives to pass these contempt of Congress citations and pursue legal action against the White House and Harriet Myers for their failure to meet the requirements of the subpoenas. Hopefully this contempt of Congress resolution will soon have a vote on the floor of the House. I am not prepared to allow this administration to operate above the law. Thank you for your continued support for a better democracy. Your friend John Conyers, Jr. And so good on you, Congressman John Conyers. You can check it out at johnconyers.com. And if you want to call your member of the House of Representatives, and each one of us has one, and if you don't know who it is, just give me your zip code. Call 202, the phone number for Congress, 202-225-3121. 202-225-3121, the main switchboard for the House, for the Capitol Hill, and just say, and I'd like to speak with my member of the House of Representatives and tell them, please support John Conyers' effort to hold the White House, the administration, in contempt of Congress. This is important stuff. This is really important stuff. And now is a very good time to be bringing this up. Ed in Hillsboro, Oregon. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind today?
Hey, good morning, Tom. Kind of picking up where the last caller left off, the word you're looking for to describe these policies is fascism, and it's time we start calling things by their proper name. I'll give you just kind of 2 pieces of evidence in support of this, but there's plenty out there. Back when democracy was in the streets in the 1960s and Reagan was out calling for a bloodbath of our college-age kids, Reagan was a fascist. In 2000, our government was seized by fascist fifth columnists who'd infiltrated the Republican Party and our judicial branch. Bush is a fascist, Cheney is a fascist, and
In the classic sense of the meaning of the word, Ed, you're absolutely right, and I totally agree, and I've been using that word for many years. In fact, I wrote one of the very first articles called, what was the title of it, The End of Democracy or Democracy at Risk or something like that, back in 2003 or in 2002, or late 2002, comparing the rise of Bush after 9/11 with the rise of Hitler after the burning of the Reichstagsgebäude by Marius von der Lubbe. And I pointed out fascism is the merging of corporate and state enterprises. And I've been saying this for a long, long time.
Well,
the
right,
problem
you know,
is...
We really need to call things by their proper names in order to understand and get to grips with them. And, you know, the bottom line is that welfare for corporations, I mean, it's not that these guys are totally against government. They like having government, you know, be in a place where they can dole out lots of money to their corporates.
Absolutely. And welfare for big corporations is part of the fascist state. I mean, this is what Hitler did. But the problem is Hitler was not a fascist. He started out using, fascist technique. Mussolini was a fascist. Franco was a fascist. Hitler was a madman, dictator, mass murderer. And so when you use the word fascist, people think that you're talking about the Nazi state. And I don't think that we're anything close to the Nazi state, frankly. We'd have a long way to go. I mean, Hitler was executing politicians who disagreed with him. He purged the Bundestag, the parliament. I mean, it's just read the William Scherer's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. We're not there. And so, yes, it is fascist. But the problem is that that's a word that you can't use in the United States because most people just don't understand what it means. But your point is well taken. Your point is very well taken. Gary in Albuquerque, New Mexico on KABQ. Hey, Gary, what's up?
I was just wanting to know what your thoughts were on the Democrats being able to stop being outmaneuvered by the Republicans all the time. from my perspective, the Republicans only have one mission, not to allow the Democrats a single victory from now until 08.
Right, and they've said it out loud. They've said it out loud. I mean, they're right up front about this, and I think that what we need to be doing is contacting Harry Reid and saying to him, don't be afraid to actually force the Republicans to really and truly stand there and talk for days at a time and have a real filibuster if they're going to try and filibuster things in the Senate, because that's where it's bottling up. I mean, Nancy Pelosi has done an extraordinary job in getting a lot of good legislation done through the House of Representatives and getting it through very quickly, frankly. And Harry Reid, and to his credit, got a lot of this stuff through committee and got it to the floor. And there, he was able to get more than 50 votes. You know, there's 100 senators. It only takes 50 votes or 51 votes, arguably, to get something passed. And he could have gotten a whole bunch of things passed, from card check, from the, you know, the employee right to join a union, to FISA, to this thing, Jim Webb's amendment yesterday to the House Defense Appropriations Bill. I mean, it actually won, but it lost because they didn't have the 60 votes. So, you know, I think that we need to be encouraging, frankly, this is my solution, for what it's worth, we need to encourage the Republicans, or the Democrats rather, to start playing hardball with the Republicans and saying to them, you want to filibuster? Fine. You're going to have to actually filibuster. You're going to have to stand there and talk. And the American people are going to see that you guys are willing to shut down Congress. You guys are willing to bring everything to a halt. And you know, there we'll go from there. Jeff in Detroit, Michigan, listening to WDTW. Hey, Jeff, just a few seconds before we've got to wrap up this hour. Something quick?
Yeah. I wanted to talk to you about a couple of things. So,
sure than I thought, actually.
Yeah.
Jeff, let me put you on hold, and we'll get back to it. I'm sorry. I thought I had about a half a minute more than I did. By the way, in our next hour, Scott Thum is coming up. We're going to be talking about the myths of megachurches, maybe myths, maybe not. And Naomi Klein will be with us in the third hour about the shock doctrine, her new book, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, along with Christy Harvey and some folks, some great bloggers. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
All right, welcome back to the second hour of our program. What do you know that you don't know? And this isn't quite one of our everything you know is wrong, but I want to have a serious conversation about this. What do you know that you don't know about what's going on with the state of religion in the United States? Or perhaps the Walmartization of religion in the United States? I should, before I begin, say as a caveat, that speaking of megachurches, Scott Thum is with us. He's the author of Beyond Megachurch Myths. His website, megachurchmyths.com. And first of all, Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us. I should state my own concerns here to begin with. Number one, I'm good friends with the pastors of two megachurches in the United States, and have been a fill-in pastor at one, and I've spoken in four megachurches over the last 10 or 12 years on different occasions. And so I have some experience of this, and both from the outside and on the inside, and I've attended some of them. That said, and I found your book, a fairly reasonably, well-balanced overview of it. That said, one of my big concerns is that what we are seeing in religion, and particularly in religion that is exempted from income tax, frankly, is a Walmart process that is destroying small churches, that is catering increasingly to the lowest common denominator, or the broadest common denominator, I frankly have some concerns about this. Take a shot at that.
Well, what we have tried to uncover was the real diversity of the megachurch phenomena itself. And, there are different types of megachurches, and they relate differently, I think, to smaller churches, to the locale that they're in, and that sort of thing. But when we look at the new congregation that develops into a megachurch and watch the other churches around that area, one of the things that you find is if they can survive past that initial fervor about this new megachurch and people going over to see what's going on, once it's established and once they've found their own role and their own niche in the area, they actually thrive relatively well in the shadow of a megachurch.
But the problem is that most of them don't. I mean, it's sort
right,
of like,
right.
You know, the when Walmart moves into an area, you may wipe out 90% of the local businesses. The 10% that are remaining are thriving because they're filling some niche that Walmart has chosen not to fill. But these churches, I mean, there's big business being done in these churches. We're talking about multi-million-dollar institutions. And it's being done very often without paying property taxes, without paying income taxes. A lot of money flowing through. Some of these folks, some of these pastors are drawing very substantial salaries, doing very well, thank you very much. And there are, frankly, I think a lot of Americans who are concerned about this. I'm also concerned about this whole social thing. It's like a symptom of the I don't know if you read the book. It was a New York Times bestseller about a decade ago. The Death of the Bowling League. I think Malcolm Dowell wrote it.
You don't mean bowling alone, do you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Bowling alone.
Robert,
yeah. Thank you.
Putnam. Yes.
Yeah, Robert Putnam, you're right. That's right. And you know, that this might be another symptom of that, that what we're seeing in megachurches is because they tend to be so, you know, kind of more plain vanilla broadly than individual churches and less denominationally oriented, that they're also less centered on individual and local community. In fact, you point out in your book how, you know, just a very small percentage of people really are basically running the megachurches. As I recall, your statistic was, you said, a typical congregation of 2,200, one would find that 110 persons, or 5% of the attendees, are core members. Not only are they the leadership elite, or the founding families, but they're also the full-time staff. So this is sort of like I said, little mini Walmarts.
Yeah, yes and no there. I mean, I think some of what you're saying is applicable to a percentage of the megachurches. But part of what we're trying to point out in the book is that there really are distinctively different types that function completely differently. And if you paint the whole phenomena with one brush, you are really doing kind of a disservice to the phenomena that really is taking American Christianity and organized religion in a sort of different direction.
Well, that's my concern. I mean, because this, you're right, it does run the whole spectrum. There are New Age megachurches. There are highly Pentecostal or highly fundamentalist new megachurches. But the vast majority of them tend to be sort of Norman Vincent Peale reincarnations, it seems.
Yeah, I think probably about maybe 30% are like that. But one of the things that megachurches are doing that's making them so appealing is they have a resonance with the place to which American society has moved in the last 30 or 40 years in a way that other congregations don't. You made a point about it's really putting smaller churches out of business. In fact, what it looks like is that megachurches are maybe making smaller churches. The challenge that's the problem is those churches in the range of 200 to 500, it seems like, that they can't compete with the small intimacy of a little church, nor can they compete with the choice of the megachurch, and therefore it's those congregations, I think, that are most threatened probably by megachurches.
Yeah. Well, here's another question or another dimension of this that I think is troubling, and that is that there's, in at least in my mind, and you know, feel free to argue with me if you want, but
sure,
I think
no
there's
problem.
A difference between religion and spirituality. Religion is the political institution, and spirituality is the personal experience. And it seems to me, again, just from my own personal experience of some of these mega churches, and some of them, particularly the one I'm thinking of, where I you know filled in one weekend, was it was actually a deeply spiritual place. I mean, it seemed there's intense spirituality associated with it. It was also very much out of the mainstream of most of the other mega churches that I know of. On the other hand, it seems like there's an awful lot of let's go for the show. Isn't this great entertainment? Who can put on the best show? Who's got the biggest choir? Oh, it's the Mormon Tabernacle, you know, that kind of thing. And what we're seeing is less spirituality and more religion. And frankly, you point out in your book about 80%, I think, of these folks tend to be Republican, or maybe it's not in your book. Maybe it was in one of the articles that came along with it. And increasingly, in many cases, politicized religion. I mean, we certainly saw this with Justice Sunday and a whole bunch of the, you know, Rick Warren is out there being very political. He's been on this program. You know, these guys are just openly political, which, you know, I think should cause them to lose their tax-exempt status, frankly. But what about this issue of the loss of spirituality in exchange for the show?
Well, what megachurches have done, in a sense, is revised our understanding of what church is about. And it's not, for a megachurch, just about what happens on the Sunday morning. Nearly every pastor I've talked to from megachurches say that if you're just coming for the show on Sunday, then, in fact, you're not being legitimate Christian that is trying.
Well, that's what every church says, but I mean, still, people do it because, you know, they go and they say, okay, well, I've done my little thing, and now I don't have to worry for the rest of the week, and I'll get to heaven, blah, blah, blah.
They do that, but at the same time, the megachurch, most of the megachurches that I've experienced are clear about saying, no, you need to also be involved in ministry, you need to be involved in small groups, you need to be connected with other people in the church, that
Book points out that that's not what happens.
Well,
that the vast majority of people are simply spectators.
According to our data, the one data set that we present in the book, I think it's nearly 70% of the attenders that we surveyed said that they were involved in small group ministry of some sort. I also try to break down the attender profile in a sort of typical megachurch, and you're right, about 40% or so would be what I would kind of call marginal or spectators, and those are really the mission field for the church. People are brought in, and they're taught to learn to think about.
These are the tire kickers that you want to bring around. Anyhow, it's an interesting conversation. Scott Thuma has written the book Beyond Megachurch Myths: What We Can Learn from America's Largest Churches. A very thought provoking. Scott, thanks for being with us today.
Sure, good talking to you, Don.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Is it 21 minutes past the hour? Welcome back. This is big business. I mean, there's actually, according to John Vaughn, the founder of Church Growth Today, in 1970, there were 10 megachurches. These are churches with at least 2,000 members. In 1990, 250 fit that decision. Today, there are 740. The net average income of each one is $4.8 million, and they pay no income taxes on it. You know, and I'm just frankly, I have to say, I'm really torn on this thing, on this whole issue, because on the one hand, it seems like what we're seeing is the Walmartization of religion, and I don't think that that's a good thing. And on the other hand, years ago I filled in for Marianne Williamson at her church in Detroit, several thousand members. I mean, it's a gas to stand up in a church in front of, you know, 2,500 people and preach a sermon, but Is that the best thing for religion? I mean, I thought that was an extraordinary church, a wonderful place. And then I hear these guys from these mega churches in the Midwest, the right wing mega churches, who are out there, you know, pushing political agendas and organizing, you know, Justice Sunday issues about we've got to get our Supreme Court justices in so that we can get our religious/political agendas promoted. And it's like, wait a minute. You know, shouldn't there be a line here? There's even a company, this is a multi-million dollar industry, a for-profit company out there that advises megachurches on how to become bigger and better megachurches, how to wipe out the small competition. When we decided to carve out the nonprofit category, and you know, I have a lot of familiarity with this. In large part because I back in 1978, Louise and I created a nonprofit, the New England Salem Children's Village, a community for abused kids up in New Hampshire, still there. What was written into the IRS code, you know, the 501c3, is that there are some things that we think are so important in our society that we're willing collectively, all the rest of us, to pay the load for these things. We're willing to collectively to pay for the fire service and the police service and the roads and the infrastructure and all the things, you know, the court system and the currency and everything, all the things that, all those parts of the commons that we all pay for with our taxes. We're willing to exempt these institutions from taxes because we think that they play a vital role in our society. And one of those is like, you know, what we started, communities for disadvantaged people or people in crisis. And another is churches. We say, you know, we collectively as a society, we said we think religion is an important thing. And yet this is now a huge industry. And enormous amounts of money are being made and spent. And there is this, you know, I've referred to it before as the deal with the devil that was made between Jerry Falwell and operatives of the Republican Party. I mean, this is when it began, back in the early Reagan days, or actually just before the early Reagan days, of basically if the Republicans would give the religious right power and money, the religious right would give the Republicans voters, because the Republican Party had historically been the party of big business, of inherited wealth and big business. And everybody understood it. I mean, they were proud of it. The fat cats, the robber barons, you know, and you know, their sales pitch to the United States was, hey, you let big business run the country well, we'll run the country well. We're big business. We know how to run things. And people bought it. And the Republicans would run things for a while, and then you'd have things like the Republican Great Depression, and it would all crash and burn, and they say, we're not going to. Well, you know, by the 50s, 60s, 70s, people had figured out, you know, we don't want to have another Republican Great Depression anymore. Thank you very much. We've seen this conservative rule. We saw it leading up to the Civil War and the crisis that created. We saw it during the robber baron era and the crisis that Teddy Roosevelt tried to resolve during the progressive era in 1901 to 1916, 1918. We saw it during the Republican, you know, run up to the Republican Great Depression, 1918 to 1929 and the crash. And so, you know, we kind of liked the New Deal era from 1932 until 1980, until the election of Reagan. And so the Republicans were on the outside looking in, and the only way that they could get enough votes, because they couldn't sell their idea of trickle-down economics anymore, because we'd been through four cycles of this in the 200-year history of this country, and we had seen that it didn't work, and we could also look at all these other countries around the world that were doing it small d democratic, you know, with functional, with regulated capitalism, not laissez-faire, not libertarian capitalism. We say, we're not going to buy it. And so the Republicans said, okay, we'll bring the religious people in on our side. And a lot of good people got duped. And a lot of, frankly, in my opinion, bad people, for lack of a better word, jumped on board and said, oh boy, money and power. Let's combine religion and politics. And the mega, and many of these mega churches are playing a role in this, and it just, it concerns me. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Yeah, calling out to America. Return to democracy. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. By the way, I said to Scott Thilma that Rick Warren, who wrote the foreword to his book, had been on our show. I was wrong. It was Rick Scarborough, the megachurch pastor who had been on this program. So I'm lousy with names. What can I say? 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Max in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Max, welcome to the program. Max? No Max. Okay. Elaine in Helsinki, Finland. Hey, Elaine.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great I am
program
well.
Today. Yeah, it's
Thank
a
you.
Great program today. I didn't have a chance to listen to yesterday's podcast, so maybe I'm a day late and a dollar short, but I wanted to talk about the fact that the dollar dropped below $1.40. And what I want the listeners to understand is if a family of four is going to come to Europe like next summer, do you realize it's going to cost you an extra $800 just to stay at a hotel for a week?
I mean, yeah, no, I was in Europe last weekend.
I know you were.
I can tell you about
next
it.
Next time, I hope you come to Helsinki and come visit me.
Well, thank you. That would be very nice.
Yeah.
And I love Helsinki. It's a beautiful city. What's the European perspective on the dollar?
Well, people are nervous about it. Of course, I mean, being, you know, I'm an American citizen. I've been living here for 4 years. But, yes, people are nervous about it. But the thing is that the European Central Bank has managed the economy quite well. I mean, the economic situation, especially in the Nordic countries, is quite good at the moment.
Yeah, it's quite healthy. Now, on the other hand, when I was there last weekend, the big pictures in all the British tabloids that I was able to pick up at the train stations and airport and whatnot were the pictures of, was it Castle Rock Bank or North Rock Bank?
Northern Rock Bank
of 500 people standing in line waiting to take all their money out. I mean, it was a picture like from 1929. And it was because the British central banker, the British equivalent of the Fed, had said last week, no, we're not going to lower interest rates and we're not going to inject money into the system because these bankers shouldn't have been making these dicey loans in the first place. And that particular bank, most of their revenues were based on these kinds of loans, and they were out and borrowing money in the marketplace to finance the loans, and the marketplace, the, you know, credit's tightening up. And finally, I guess yesterday, the British Central Bank has come around, and everybody's breathing a sigh of relief. But this way, at least that was the story I saw on BBC News last night. But it still seems like we're on a knife's edge.
We are. And again, I would love to hear Ravi Batra. I enjoy it when you speak with him. As a matter of fact, I think he should be a weekly segment along with Bernie Sanders, because how can we sustain this? I mean, eventually
people we can't.
Are going to start to dump the dollar.
Yeah. And unless we get our economic house in order. And the amazing thing, Alan, is that it's not rocket science to do this. I mean, if we were to raise taxes on the wealthy, right now the middle class are paying higher taxes than they were when Nixon was president. If we were to lower taxes on the middle class to the levels in terms of real inflation adjusted dollars to the levels they were at during Nixon's presidency and raise taxes on millionaires and billionaires to the the levels they were, 71% during Nixon's presidency. And if we were to simply do away with the cap on Social Security, so people making more than $90,000 a year, you know, so that Bill Gates is paying the exact same amount of a percentage of his income in Social Security taxes as I am, it would solve the Social Security problem. It would solve all these crises, and yet these politicians are terrified to do it because of the power of inherited wealth and because of the power of these CEOs who are in this revolving door with Congress. But anyhow, I got to move along. But Elaine, thank you very much for the call. It's great to hear from
you.
You're
welcome, Tom.
Thanks for listening to the web stream over there in Helsinki, Finland. Michael in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Michael, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I had a couple comments. First comment I wanted to make was, if you look at the fathers of the evangelical movement, the people who were known to be the people that kind of spawned it, such as Karl Barth from Germany, he was definitely a very socialistic man. Like, he had a lot of very socialistic ideas, which is a great change from the common perspective now in the evangelical church.
Well, I think you could argue that Martin Luther was largely socialistic. He felt I don't know about his relationship to government. But in any case, yes, your point is well made.
And the other thing I was going to say is, well, I lived in Germany about 10 years growing up. My father was the evangelical minister there. And the people in Germany, the Christians in Germany, evangelical Christians, seem to have a very balanced view of what you were just talking about earlier, about how we need to stay out of being so political and be more mindful of what the gospel actually talks about instead of getting our nose into politics where it doesn't really belong.
Right, which gets us back to this discussion actually it was Marianne Williamson, to mention her name again, who first enlightened me about it, made the comment that conservative morality has to do with what are people doing in secret in their bedrooms, and, you know, what are they smoking, what kind of sex are they having, and in what position, and liberal morality has to do with, are we following the teachings of the Old and New Testament and of the Quran and every other religious scripture, which is to care for the weak, to feed the hungry, to raise up the poor, to visit those in prison, to heal the sick. I mean, just pretty straightforward stuff. I mean, that's pretty straightforward stuff. Dwayne, and thanks for the call. Dwayne in Longmont, Colorado, also listening on KKZN. Hey, Dwayne, what's up?
Yes, Tom. First of all, thank you very much for your voice. And I'm calling from Longmont, Colorado. We are facing a situation here where a very large mega church, 3,500 members now, with a stated goal by their one of the representatives to become a 20,000-member church. There's an annexation that just went through where they are going to be annexed into the city, a new parcel of land, 348 acres. And in that 348 acres, is going to be, of all things, a sports arena and 600,000 square feet of commercial space. They're going to be building houses, and I think the median price is close to $1 million on those houses.
Christian community?
Yeah,
I mean, is this the religious equivalent of the communities that spring up around golf courses?
Yeah, yes, very, very similar, very, very similar. And what's I think is alarming to me on just kind of a symbolic level is that it's named the Union Annexation. And these people, the Lifebridge folks, have had one of their elders was voted in as a county commissioner when the land was actually rezoned.
That doesn't smell so well. But
no,
but you know, there's this larger issue, Dwayne, and that is, and we're seeing it. I mean, at the corporate level, it's really easy to say, okay, let's enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act and say that, you know, ExxonMobil cannot control oil from the wellhead to the retail outlet, that it's against the law. I mean, it used to be against the law. Or let's enforce the Sherman Act and say that we can't have just five companies basically controlling any given industry you want to name, from publishing to broadcasting to energy. And on the other hand, I don't know that there's a Sherman Act for churches, you know, and it would be fascinating to go back and, you know, I've seen some huge cathedrals in Europe, and, you know, before 1800, there were fewer than 1 billion people on the planet. We have 6 billion now. So some of these huge cathedrals in Europe that were built 200-300 years ago were probably the mega churches of their day. And it would be fascinating. And yet at the same time, the Catholic Church has always had a large commitment to community outreach and to local churching, as well as these kind of, you know, St. Patrick's Cathedral stuff. And it'd be fascinating to look at the history of it. I'm observing it as a phenomena. I'm concerned about it. I don't know where to go, though, with it.
What's happening right now, Tom, is the citizens of Longmont have a referendum petition on this annexation to get it on the ballot. And I believe that these sorts of things should go on to into a larger arena than just the city council. And we're in the last days of getting the signature drive together on this. And if I could give the website address for
sure.
this
sure.
To get more information on it, the big question is the tax situation.
Yeah, and this and maybe that's the thing. Maybe at a certain point, and really maybe even at any point, maybe we need to amend our IRS code and say that if a local community does not want to grant tax-exempt status to an institution, if they don't believe that institution is actually serving the entire community or is doing some, although then you'd get into problems of, you know, like down in the South where you've got communities that are way out of the mainstream, shall we say. Again, it's a tough one. But anyhow, the website for the folks in Colorado.
Well, just one quick thing. Here's an important issue. If the tax status is such that it doesn't pay for the services that the community is providing to this area, then there could be an ongoing long-term situation in which the city is having to subsidize through services this
Sure, but that's always the case. That's always been the case with churches and with hospitals and with homes for abused kids. That's always been the case. We've always just had a social consensus that that's an acceptable thing.
Right.
That's a reasonable thing. And then you get to a church with 20,000 members that's occupying, you know, a couple hundred acres of land and has a theme park or something, you know, the Jim and Tammy Faye thing. And at that point you go, hey, wait a minute, is this what we really meant to subsidize?
Right. The website address is whatsinitforlongmont.org, and there's going to be a very large final push on Sunday morning in Thompson Park.
Okay, great. Dwayne, thanks a lot for the heads up. I appreciate it. whatsinitforlongmont.org for the folks in Longmont, Colorado, listening on KKZN. And I mean, as I said, whichever side of this issue you want to come down on, I think there are a lot of these issues out there where it's not entirely black and white, and at the same time, it is important that we be having these conversations. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Main fact on the factor is the facts are often wrong. Slander those who can't defend themselves without an ounce of shame. Make everything about himself, and that's how he became.
Vicious, and that is with a capital D, person who's blinded by ideology.
You might be someone who'll dig it. You might be O'Reilly's kind, especially if you're a bigot with a closed and tiny mind.
Shut up!
If you have no use for reason, then you'll love the way he acts. And he'll tell you what you want to hear, regardless of the facts.
They're not facts.
Bill O'Reilly finally found a home when Fox News came along. A place he could ignore the truth and get the facts all wrong. Faced with a truth he can't refute, then he'll call you a name.
You're a lunatic.
He'll thumb his nose, the legend goes that that's how he became.
A snide, condescending idiot.
The big giant head. The big giant head.
This kind of stuff is rejected by most sane people, but gullible people absorb it.
Yeah. Go ahead. And just as a final note.
So, all those clowns over at the Liberal Radio Network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Yeah, all those folks over at that Liberal Radio Network. All right. Anyhow, welcome back 9.5 minutes before the hour, and sometimes it just gets weirder. Wow! Weirder and weirder and weirder out there. George W. Bush, we've been talking about economics here briefly today, and his thoughts about...
Do you think there's a risk of a recession? How do you rate that?
You know, you need to talk to economists. I think I got a B in that Econ 101. I got an A, however, in keeping taxes low and being fiscally responsible with the people's money.
No, that's these are great laugh lines. First of all, he got a C-minus if you go back and look at his grades in Econ 101. And I'm telling you, Econ 101, that's a pretty hard class to get a C-minus in. And secondly, nobody has given him an A in keeping the taxes low, because the taxes are going to be paid. It's just that they're not going to be paid by his rich buddies. They're going to be paid by you and me and your children and my children and your grandchildren and my grandchildren, because this man has borrowed trillions of dollars and spent it and has set us up to borrow trillions more. That is not fiscal responsibility. That's fiscal insanity, plain old, pure and simple. Fred in Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Fred, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. Just speaking to to what you just said about taxes, I believe that taxes are bound to go through the roof because of the tremendous tax burden that's been imposed on us, and the unfunded liabilities of Social Security and Medicare.
Yeah, that's my point. All they need to do is get rid of the cap, and you won't have an unfunded liability anymore.
Yeah,
we are looking.
I mean, people think that taxes are high now. Just wait until this really hits the fan. But that's not what I'm calling about. I'm calling to make a comment about your earlier interview with the gentleman that was on. In regards to the megachurches, you made reference to the book Bowling Alone, and I read that. And as you recall, the author makes an interesting point in there. He says that he talks about the genesis of the current megachurches, and I'm speaking really specifically of the televangelist churches. But he goes back into the history of these churches, and he recounts that in the beginning, these churches were what we commonly call at this point revival meetings. In other words, they would go out into some cornfield someplace and pitch a great big tent, you know. And have their meetings.
Billy Sunday, Amy Semple McPherson, I think it was, and whatnot. I mean, some of them were famous, some of them were infamous, but
right. Yeah. And at that point, they were apolitical. I mean, they didn't want anything to do with politics. Okay, they avoided it like it was some kind of disease, like it was something dirty to get involved in.
No, and the churches, frankly, I think right across the board need to come back to that. Fred, I got to move along, but you're thank you for the point and well made. Becky in Portland, Oregon on KPOJ. Hey, Becky.
Hi there. Hey, a few weeks ago I was listening and you had a gentleman call from the beautiful little community of Duffer. I know you know where that is.
Hmm.
Duffer,
Oregon.
He was only on for a second and he said he was surprised that you were talking about being a Christian. And I thought, man, we are just such in a minority. People just assume if you're a Christian, you're way right wing and you don't care about anything.
Yeah, Jesus was the original liberal.
Yeah.
And frankly, as I said, there are some liberal mega churches out there. You know, Marianne Williamson's church in Detroit, the Church of Today. There's one in San Diego. The week that I spent with the Dalai Lama in India, the pastor of a very, very large church in Los Angeles was with us. Without going through a whole long list, I mean, there's liberal ones as well.
Our swelled head Limbaugh say a few weeks ago that. On one of the rapid pass-bys I ever listened to him, that said it's okay to have a presidential debate on Sunday mornings because Democrats don't go to church. But then the other side of it is I'm discussing the Bush administration and all the politics with my friends, my non-Christian friends, and said something about, you know, getting him out or something. They said they'll never get him out. The Christians are behind him, and they don't care about the environment.
Yeah. And that's the tragedy is that those people think that that's Christianity. I mean, that is so much the tragedy. Becky, thank you very much for the call. We have just a few seconds here to wrap up this hour. Bill in San Diego, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Good. But I'll get better. What's up?
Well, my comment was, especially here in California and in Hawaii, to be specific, the Mormon and Catholic churches own hundreds of thousands of acres of privately held land, and they pay no property tax on it whatsoever. Yeah. I think most Americans have no problem with tax-free places to worship at all. I don't.
Right, right. The deal that we made with them was we'll cover those taxes if you'll stay out of politics. That's the deal we made with them, and that deal is being broken on a daily basis. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio. Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
And welcome back. In the first hour of our program, we were talking about broadly how 26 years of insane economic policies and insane foreign policies based on a bizarre ideology that Reagan brought into the White House when he declared the end of the New Deal and the beginning of a new era. A doctrine that many people would call fascism, although not Nazism, but more, you know, Francoism or Mussoliniism or something like that. Absolute laissez-faire capitalism, unregulated, unrestrained capitalism, and that somehow this was going to transform the world in a positive way. And we talked about the destruction of democracy around the world that has come about as a consequence of the military end of what we've been doing and the political end of what we've been doing. And I mentioned later we would be talking about the economic end of it. Naomi Klein is with us. She has a new book that speaks right to this issue. It's called The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. Her website is shockdoctrine.com. Is that .org? No, which is it?
Both.
Okay, good, because I typed it in, and now it's saying NaomiKlein.org. It flipped over, so I guess NaomiKlein.org works as well. Naomi, welcome to the program.
All roads lead there. Hi, Tom.
There you go. Hi. Great to have you back with us. You are absolutely one of my favorite writers, and you do such brilliant, brilliant work. And in your book, you start back in the 1970s, and really before that, with this bizarre ideology that democracy is kind of a quaint and antiquated, and the founders had it wrong, and it really should just be the unfettered marketplace should be running everything, and it didn't work so well, so we had to kind of force it on people, starting in Latin America.
Yeah, I mean, the book is really an alternative history of how this radical brand of total laissez-faire, except for when the fair interests the corporations, in which case they're fully in favor of all kinds of intervention and subsidies. But yeah, this sort of corporate rule, how it came to sweep the globe. And I think we know the fairy tale version of this story. And we heard it when Milton Friedman died last year, which is, you know, that this ideology swept the globe on the wings of freedom and democracy because people wanted their radical capitalism along with their Big Macs after the Berlin Wall fell. And, you know, we've all heard all this. What I do in the book is I look at how the great leaps forward for this campaign, like Chile in 1973 under Pinochet, Thatcher and her push to privatize the economy.
In 79.
Yeah. What I do is I look at all these key junctures, and I show that in each case there was a major shock or a major crisis that laid the groundwork that created an atmosphere of crisis or a state of emergency, which really suspended the normal rules of democracy and allowed this ideology to leap forward. So it's a challenge to the central claim of these ideologues that you can equate free markets and democracy, because I actually think that the real story shows that they've been at war for quite some time, and sometimes it's the army tanks that flatten the democracy, and sometimes it's the think tanks, who I refer to the people who are paid to think by the makers of tanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, you lay out in the book how the people, the populace, not just of the United States, but all over the world, were essentially prepared for this by these very well-funded think tanks that emerged in the late 60s, mostly in the 70s and into the early 1980s.
Yeah, and the think tanks are really a very conscious attempt to deal with this ideological campaign's democracy problem, you know. I start the book at the University of Chicago in the 1950s, which was this laboratory for this war against the New Deal, and it was, you know, very tight with Wall Street, and it was a very deliberate counter-revolution against the New Deal, and it was, you know, it was funded by some of the largest corporations in America who were fed up with having to share so much of the wealth with unions, with the middle class, and felt it was time to turn the tides. And Milton Friedman really became their man because Milton Friedman was such a great popularizer. You know, these aren't original ideas, but he was very, very adept at selling them to mass audiences. But in the 50s and 60s, they were voices in the wilderness. They were very, very marginal because Keynesianism still ruled. And the real disillusioning moment with democracy for the Chicago boys and Milton Friedman was when Nixon came to office. And Milton Friedman writes in his memoirs that when Nixon was elected, he really thought that he had a kindred spirit in the White House. And, of course, he was an advisor, and he really thought things were going to swing his way. And one of his sort of proteges, a young Donald Rumsfeld, was even and George Shultz, also another one of his colleagues at the University of Chicago, was budget director. And so he thought his time had come. And what actually happened was that the American people demanded government intervention to deal with inflation, and suddenly Rumsfeld and George Shultz were having to impose wage and price controls. So it was this experience, because, you know, as far as Friedman was concerned, Nixon was pandering to the masses, that made him really become disillusioned with electoral democracy. And then, you know, I guess you could argue that Nixon kind of threw him a bone and gave him his own little laboratory, which was Chile, hardly a democracy under Augusto Pinochet, where the Chicago boys were really able to rewrite the rules of that country.
Yeah, and they've done this in a whole variety of countries since then, from South Africa to Russia, using the instruments of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's high time that this ideological campaign was held to account for its crimes. You know, it's a healthy process when you have extreme ideologies and they're forced to reckon with what it actually takes to implement their ideas. And, you know, this project for me came out of my reporting in Iraq, where, you know, I was there after the first year of the invasion, reporting on Paul Bremer's adventures and his attempts.
Right, you wrote a brilliant piece for, was it The Nation, as I recall?
It was for Harper's, Baghdad
for
Year
Harper's.
Zero.
For Harper's, yeah. Baghdad Year Zero, yep.
And I think we talked about it at the time, about this crusade to sort of treat Iraq as a blank slate, and turn it into this dream world for Republicans. You know, the flat tax and the, you know, investment law that allowed them to take 100% of the profits out, and all of that sort of extreme country makeover stuff that Paul Bremer did in that first year. And this, you know, I think that, you know, we understand that measures like dissolving the Iraqi army and firing civil servants contributed to the rise of the armed resistance. But, you know, what I do in the book is look, you know, at how this really was a backlash against this ideological campaign, that the resistance rose up as a direct response to Paul Bremer's measures. And so this is, you know, one example of where I think an ideology really does need to be held accountable for the people who die because of it. And that's, you know, this whole project is about looking backwards at other places where it has required real force to push through this ideology. I look at Tiananmen Square, for instance, and a new analysis that's coming out of China from a new wave of intellectuals who are talking about how the Tiananmen Square massacre wasn't just about students saying they wanted an American-style democracy. It was that people were demanding democratic control over the country's transition to a capitalist economy. And that democratic control would have meant that it wouldn't have been this sort of brutal experiment in radical free market economics that Milton Friedman was prescribing at the time. He had been in China 8 months before the massacre. And so the Communist Party in China had a choice, you know, either have democracy and a less radical economic experiment, or crush those students, and he called in the tanks. So, you know, that's what I mean by an alternative history, because I think we have these snapshots, but we don't understand them.
Right. For China, it was either go the direction of Pinochet or go the direction of Sweden, and they chose the Pinochet direction. We're talking with Naomi Klein, her new book, Shock Doctrine, Rise of Disaster Capitalism, shockdoctrine.com, the website. Naomi, we just have a little less than a minute left here. I'm looking for a word. I describe this stuff sometimes as laissez-faire economics, crazy conservative economics. Fascism is too loaded a word. We need a word to describe this.
You know, the word I ended up with is corporatism. And corporatism, you know, is close to fascism. It's an alliance between big government and big business within the context of a security state, of a surveillance state. And there used to be a third party in that equation, which was big labor. I think in our contemporary age, it's big business, big government ganging up on working people and using the privatized security apparatus to do it.
Yeah, corporatism. That's a good one. I've used that
see
word
how that
before.
Works for you.
We need to start spreading it far and wide.
Okay.
Naomi Klein, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. The website, by the way, is more than just about the book. A lot of great information there, shockdoctrine.com. And, of course, the book is brilliant, and you have to buy it and read it. The Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein. Naomi, thank you for being with us today.
Great to talk to you again, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Leaders are a pain in the neck. Can't hold a candle to Chiang Kai-shek. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News. Then the bombers are afraid of a fight. Peace hurts business and that ain't right. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News.
Yes, looking at the news. Christy Harvey with us with the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, their website, and ThinkProgress.org. She's the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress. Hey, Christy.
Hey, I'm digging that music. I was kind of dancing over here in the studio.
There you go.
I like it.
Good.
How you doing?
I am great, but I'll get better. And I hope all is well with you as well.
It is, but once again, all I have to talk about is depressing stuff.
Well,
that's what happens when you live to expose corruption. One day I'll come with fun stories.
I guess, but you know, my philosophy is I'm not going to complain about something if I can't offer a solution at the same time. Let's always try to say, okay, here's the problem. Here's the, you know, what's the solution? For example, you got Tom Coburn putting a hold on the Presidential Records Act, you know, trying
right.
to secretly do it. And, you know, we need to be calling Tom Coburn's office, the senator from Oklahoma, as I recall, and say, hey, you know, this isn't right. What are you trying to do? Hold up
I
the
like
Senate
the way
here?
You think.
Yeah, I mean, this passed the House 333-93, according to your blog over at the thinkprogress.org. And
right.
I mean, this is the will of the American people. Who does this guy think he is? So anyway, I wanted to talk with you about, you know, our regular segment here. What's going under the radar? What are the stories that we really should be paying attention to that probably aren't going to make it into the CBS Evening News kind of thing?
Well, I was absolutely shocked that this one wasn't everywhere. There was a new GAO report yesterday, the Government Accountability Office. They're sort of the watchdogs for government, and they keep an eye on the good, the bad, and the ugly. And they had a new study that said basically that America's veterans are still at risk of having their identity stolen because a year and a half later, the Veterans Affairs Department still has not implemented all of the necessary safety measures that last year and 18 months ago they said, oh, sure, we're on that right now.
So, maybe that's because the guy who's the head of the Veterans Affairs, well, actually, that's the Veterans Administration, the VA is the Veterans Administration.
Exactly.
The guy who's the head of it, Jim Nicholson, you know, his main claim to fame is that he was a wealthy Republican lawyer and hack from Colorado who raised a couple hundred thousand bucks for George W. Bush.
Absolutely. He fits in my book. He fits into the whole doing a heck of a job there, Brownie, kind of category, because he was not especially qualified to run something like this. And you remember the original story was first the VA lost personal info on like 26.5 million veterans when a computer was stolen out of someone's house. Then a few months later, they lost a laptop that had all this information on it. And so they did this big study. They said this is exactly what needs to happen and happen fast to make sure that our vets aren't at risk. And at the time, Jim Nicholson said that, you know, the VA will become, quote, the gold standard in data security. And everyone said, yay, great, we believe you. And this new report came out, and the VA hasn't secured its computer network. It hasn't figured out all the authorizations. Things are still really risky for vets. And the real kicker, the head of the Information Security Department, the person supposed to be implementing this, that position's been open since June 06. They haven't even bothered to put someone in charge.
Which brings us back to the problem of having conservatives run who don't believe in government, running government, because if you don't believe in government, you can't govern.
Exactly.
I mean, it's really, really quite simple. And so you know, there's an easy solution, and that is we all need to get as politically active as we can to get as many Democrats elected or independents like Bernie Sanders elected to the House and the Senate and to local offices and just, you know, basically take back this country because enough of this craziness. Another dimension of the craziness is how the policies, particularly of the Bushies and the Republican handmaidens of the Bushies, have caused the Muslim world to view us.
Oh, yeah. There's a new poll put out by the Pew Research Center, which is, in Nicholson's words, the gold standard of polling. And they did an international poll, and it basically shows that Muslims' views of the U.S. are going through the floor. Our favorability, for example, in Turkey, who's supposed to be our big NATO ally, it's down 9%. Since last
it's not
year,
down nine. It's down
2.9%. It's down from 30% 5 years ago and 52% in 2000. So from 2000, 52% of people in Turkey had a positive view of us. Now nine.
Yeah, that's really grim. That's really grim. I mean,
it's not just the war on terror that's driving this down. It's how we're handling it. You know, I really blame. We talked earlier this week about the inspector general over at the State Department who basically was trying to block investigations into fraud, waste and abuse over in Iraq. And we found out today that the State Department conceded basically that they have not been following up on any of these complaints about abuse from security contractors like Blackwater. And so there's a direct link. Things like Blackwater happen really, really upset the Iraqi people, really make the entire community lose absolute trust in us because we will not, you know, look after what's going on. We will not investigate these claims of all this violence that was being perpetrated by Blackwater. And then we go, well, why don't they like us?
Right. Yeah.
Why do they hate
and
us?
And finally, you note that Mike Conaway, the Republican from Texas, wants a law requiring all members of Congress to read the Constitution once a year. I'm actually in favor of that.
I think it would be a good idea. But it came out the day that Congress decided to kill habeas corpus, and I thought, instead of requiring everyone to read the Constitution, how about just protect it?
Yeah,
you know?
Enforce it, yeah. to protect and defend, execute the Constitution, absolutely. Christy Harvey, the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website, ThinkProgress.org. Christy, thanks so much for being
Pleasure
with us.
Pleasure as always.
27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
It's time for our Best of the Rest of the News segment, where we check in with some of the folks out there in the tubes, not the trucks, on the Internet. Yes, and find out what's going on. First, some breaking news, news of my own here. All over the right-wing websites, they are all absolutely hysterically bloviating about the fact that Hillary Clinton has compared Dick Cheney with a movie figure, shall we say. So we checked in with Mr. Cheney's office to see what his thoughts were and his comment was.
You don't know the power of the dark side.
So apparently Hillary is right. I mean, what can I say? Anyhow, Paul Waldman is with us. He's a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, mediamatters.org, one of the really great websites that holding the media accountable for what they're saying and what they're doing. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks. How are you?
Great, great. And John Quayle is with us. He is the assistant editor of Common Dreams, the largest progressive website in the United States, a place where all of the op-ed pieces I've been writing for the last 5 years are first appear, commondreams.org. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
Great to have you both with us. Let me start with you, John, if you don't mind. What do you see as the two biggest stories right now that we really, really should be attending to that perhaps the mainstream press is not entirely noticing, or maybe? What do you see as the top issues?
Well, whether or not they're noticing them or not, or the way that they've been framed in the mainstream media, there are, you know, perhaps too many to count, but I mean, on the top of our headlines are things that you may recognize, but today at Common Dreams we have talking about Iraqi refugees again, that the Iraqi Red Crescent released a report yesterday, and there's an article today in The Guardian from out of the UK discussing both internal refugees and the external refugees from Iraq, which is not, you know, in the wake of the Petraeus assessment, has not received the same sort of clarity that it might otherwise.
So, I don't think the average American realizes that the second largest refugee crisis in the world, behind Darfur and Sudan, is happening in Iraq right now and around Iraq.
That's true.
You're
seeing both the first major migration that happened in perhaps 2006. Sort of being followed now by a second, sort of these waves where people, refugees who have left their homes originally, migrating to safer areas are now finding that those areas aren't so safe and needing to, flee again. And it's creating this progression of crisis.
Right. And huge numbers of these people, probably the majority of them are children. It's an absolute disaster. Paul Waldman, over a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, mediamatters.org. Paul, what are you seeing in the media that you consider to be the top stories of the day?
Well, there are a couple of stories I think that have been sort of overlooked that may not be the most pressing and urgent thing, but I find interesting. One is that on Monday there was a value voter debate among Republican candidates that got almost no coverage in the media. But what was really notable about it was that all of the leading candidates, Mitt Romney, Rudy Giuliani, Fred Thompson, John McCain, they all skipped it. And the only ones who came were sort of second-tier candidates, Mike Huckabee and Tom Tancredo, Sam Brownback. And here you have what we've understood for a long time to be the real base of the Republican Party, those social conservative Christian voters, and this was supposed to be the debate that was going to get all the candidates there to answer their questions and to pander to them in the same way that Democrats are supposed to pander to their base, and yet all the leading candidates didn't even show up. And I think that indicates that there are some interesting fissures right now in the Republican Party, that perhaps the establishment of the Republican Party is getting a little bit skittish about their base and what that base, the message that they send to the rest of the country. So I think that's something that's good.
Well, or perhaps about their candidates. I mean, you've got Fred Thompson who is on his second wife and you know, sometimes referred to as a trophy wife, a woman much younger than him. And who made most for 20 years made his living, multi-million-dollar living as a Gucci shoed lot, literally. His photo of his Gucci shoes on Think Progress last week. Lobbyist. Doesn't much go to church and doesn't like to talk about it. You got Rudy Giuliani, who's, on his third wife. I don't think the Catholic Church views that in a very favorable light. And you got Mitt Romney, who is a Mormon, which is a religion that many evangelical Protestants, which is the traditional base now of the Republican Party, at least over the last 10, 15 years, or a good chunk of the base, don't even view as Christians necessarily. And so each one of these guys, I would guess, had a lot to lose if they started answering questions about these kinds of issues.
Well, there's no question about that. But I think this is one of the interesting things about the Republican race, is that at the same time you have these candidates who have issues with some of that Christian conservative base, and at the same time they are getting a little bit nervous about what it would require for them to pander to them. So that's one interesting thing about the that's going on in the Republican Party right now. The other story that I wanted to bring up, we all heard a lot about Hillary Clinton's health care plan this week, or at least the politics of it. But what I found interesting, and what a lot of people didn't point out, some people observed that it was very, very similar to the plan that John Edwards put out a little while back. But what people didn't notice was that both of them include a government, in effect, single-payer plan. It's not single-payer for everybody, but a government plan akin to Medicare that anyone could join in their health care plans. Now, this is something that a little while ago would have been derided as crazy, wacky, European-style socialism. Now, it's true that the Republicans are going to say that about pretty much anything that the Democrats put out. But the fact that two of the three leading candidates saw fit to put that in their health care plans, I think is really remarkable, and it indicates that there's been a broad movement to the left on this issue. You know, a while back, we at Media Matters for America, along with the Campaign for America's Future, put out a report called The Progressive Majority, where we detailed how the public is really quite progressive on a whole broad range of issues. Healthcare is certainly one of them, and I think that what this shows is that the politicians are beginning to catch up and offer the kind of a plan that a lot of progressives have been advocating for a long time.
Yeah, and I had a conversation with John Edwards about this on this program, and I said, you got all this complicated stuff, and then, oh, by the way, you can buy into Medicare, and isn't the bottom line ultimately going to be that because Medicare is so much more efficient, it doesn't pay multimillion-dollar CEO salaries, it doesn't pay stock dividends, it doesn't have marketing costs, that it's ultimately going to put all these health insurance companies out of business? And his answer was, yeah, that's the whole point of it. This is the only way to do it, you know, that's politically palatable. But basically the bottom line is that over time, with this program, you know, if you offer that as an option to everybody, what you're going to end up with is Medicare for everybody.
And the remarkable thing is that he's being so open about that. And on his website, it even says in the written plan that if enough people choose this and we end up evolving to a single-payer healthcare system, that would be fine.
Right.
Which is pretty remarkable.
He's in a pragmatic way saying what Dennis Kucinich is saying in a way that frankly I think would be just taken apart, which is, you know, just, you know, shut down all the health insurance companies and go to Medicare for all immediately, which I think would be a great idea, but you know, it's not politically palatable. And I think that there's some brilliance there on his part and apparently on Hillary's as well. Interesting. John Quayle, back to commondreams.org. What do you see on the horizon? What are the stories that you're seeing bubbling up through Common Dreams that we should be paying attention to that over the next week or so or beyond are going to, you know, blow up in our faces or that we're going to really have to know about?
Well, this could come back again to something that happened in the Senate yesterday, which has been sort of under the wire compared to the Webb amendment for the troop drawdown that or the rotation legislation that got defeated in the Senate, was that the habeas corpus legislation also failed by the same numbers yesterday. But we're going to see that or a version of that come out of the House next week. And so habeas corpus hasn't really got the same play and what's going on in Guantanamo that in the last 24 hours in the news cycle. But I think you're going to hear that. And there's some interesting trends coming out of that. There's been a lot of progress made, like Paul's suggesting, maybe in healthcare. In the last couple of years, we've come a little bit further down the road in terms of how we assess that situation. So hopefully as that issue comes throughout the House and if the media can look to tackle it, we can see how...
Are you hearing any vibe out there at all that Harry Reid and the Democratic leadership in the Senate may start saying to the Republicans, okay, guys, you want to have a filibuster, get the bucket to put by your leg in the tube like they used to do in the old days?
Well, I think I heard you suggest earlier in the program, and I think that's exactly right. We haven't heard that exactly said, but I think that's certainly what we need to see happen. I mean, these threats of filibusters are one thing, and, you know, actually witnessing a filibuster is another thing, and really holding the Republicans who feel this way about the MCA and other things to really defend themselves and see what those arguments look like. And I think the more the public is aware of what those arguments look like, they will be much less convinced that this is the direction the country should be headed in.
Yep. And Paul Waldman over at MediaMatters.org, I think we have about a minute and a half left here, so... just half a minute. What do you see on the horizon?
I would also focus on Iraq. You know, after General Petraeus' testimony, all of the commentary in the press was how great he was and how he just outflanked the Democrats. What we actually saw in the polls that were taken right after that and that continue to be taken is that it didn't move public opinion at all, despite the fact that the White House was supposed to have won this PR victory. And then this week, the Pentagon issued its update on security in Iraq that shows that things are actually much worse than General Petraeus tried to paint them. And I think you're going to see further erosion of the White House's position among the public.
So when are the Democrats going to figure this out?
Well, that's the eternal question, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
if
it,
I had
it really
answer
is.
To that one.
Yeah, I get people calling up saying, "Oh, we've got to, you know, impeach Nancy Pelosi or something like, you know." I mean, and my comment is, no, call Nancy Pelosi, call Harry Reid, and say, "We've got your back. We're with you. Don't be afraid. Don't, you know, feel free to stand up to these guys. It's time to stand up and get a spine. And we need to encourage them and strengthen them." Anyway, Paul Waldman, MediaMatters.org, John Quayle. CommonDreams.org. John and Paul, thank you both for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Good talking with you both. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
My friends, we can build an America that really, really, truly holds to its values. Rather than, you know, we've covered a lot of territory today, from the military-industrial complex to the ministry-industrial complex. Probably the most articulate spokesman, the late Jerry Falwell.
You got to kill the terrorists before the killing stops. And I'm for the president. Chase them all over the world. If it takes 10 years, blow them all away in the name of the Lord.
Yeah. Thank you, Jerry. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Tristan in Greenfield, Massachusetts, listening on WHMP. Hey, Tristan.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be speaking with you. What an honor.
Well, thank you for calling. What's up?
Well, I was thinking about what you were talking about earlier with mega churches. And, Tom, I got to tell you, it sounded like you sounded so worried that you were willing to gut the First Amendment. And I wanted to offer a different view.
Wait a minute. I'm worried that I'm willing to gut the First Amendment?
Well, you know, there is.
What am I missing here?
Well, yeah. Well, I think you're missing freedom of religion, and mega churches should have it. But I'm not.
I agree. The First Amendment does not guarantee churches freedom from taxation.
That's true, although it's been interpreted at points to do so.
No, it has not. It has not. It has never been interpreted that way. Never. Absolutely never. It was during the administration of Lyndon Johnson that we started giving tax exempt status to churches. And it was a deal that was cut between Lyndon Johnson and churches that basically, if you guys stop involving yourselves in politics, we'll cut you some slack and we'll not tax you. And that was the explicit deal. It was written into the Internal Revenue Code. It's got nothing to do with the Constitution. It's got nothing to do with freedom of speech or religion.
Okay, Tom, let me get my point out, and then we'll clash, okay? Because, and by the way, I have a great amount of respect for you, and I am a liberal. But my idea is simply that if people are willing to remember that in America, in a democracy, we have the freedom to think for ourselves. And as Christians, especially if we're Protestant, thanks to the example of Martin Luther, we have to think for ourselves. We don't need priests or preachers to tell us how to think or what God wants us to do. That seems to be the message that counters the threat of the groupthink propagated within megachurches, who are becoming a political force, which I think we all think is a problem. And it is. It is dangerous when you're able to marshal hundreds of thousands of people to vote a certain way because, you know, the man at the single pulpit in front of 20,000 people tells them to do so.
Right, which brings us back to my original point, which is at some point do we have to say we're going to draw a line in the sand with regard to taxes, not with regard to what you can say or what you've been doing or anything like that, but as to, and I'm sorry, Tristan, the background is really loud there, but as to whether or not we're going to pay for your police protection, we're going to pay for your fire protection, we're going to pay for the maintenance of your roads. Because during the Johnson administration, we made this deal. And I continue to be torn on that, frankly. Ian in San Francisco, California. Hey, Ian, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Great show today.
Thank you.
I wanted to do was, you kind of stole my thunder on this matter of what the Democrats ought to do with respect to the filibuster. The way it's being reported now in the press is that the Webb bill, for instance, the Webb amendment, was defeated. That's the way they put it, defeated 56-44, as if 56 voted against it and 44 voted for it. And what I think is exactly right, what you're saying, is that what they need to do is say, we can't move any further until the Republicans get a chance to say what they say they still have to say. They say they're not through talking on this, and we'll just let them talk. And we can't move on to anything else until we give them that chance.
That's right. And that's my call to Harry Reid and to, frankly, to my two senators, to Ron Wyden and Gordon Smith, is if the Republicans want a filibuster legislation, let them filibuster it, but let's have a real filibuster.
And you know what will happen? If Harry Reid will just do that, then the press will come to Harry Reid and they'll say, why aren't you moving on other things? And he'll say, because the Republicans say they're not through talking on this.
Right.
And
that's
I want
right.
to give them that chance. And then the Republicans will have to explain what's going on. And then finally the press will start to report exactly what's happening, which is that there's a 60-vote requirement to end debate.
That's right. And it'll blow up in the Republicans' face. It'll blow up in the Republicans' face exactly the way the Republicans engineered the threat of a filibuster on the Alito hearing to blow up in the Democrats' face. You're absolutely right. And that's or at least in my opinion. So, Steve in Wisconsin. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I enjoyed very much your conversation with Naomi Klein. I think you should invite her for a whole show because
she's brilliant.
So brilliant, yeah, and she's the best voice.
But did you have a question or point? Because we've only got about 45 seconds here before the end of the show, so, Steve.
Okay, there's a lot of talk nowadays about martial law in this country and police brutality and the state of emergency that we live in since September 11. And I highly recommend everybody read the Shock Doctrine from Naomi Klein because she describes several such movements that defied martial law. One is the Solidarity Movement. They lived under martial law between December of 81 and July of 83. They emerged from it stronger than ever.
Lex Valenza.
In Romania, we had martial law on December 17, 1989.
Right. You took down Ceausescu.
Yes, it's no big deal. The places where it didn't work was China, Tiananmen Square, and largely because they didn't have a strong union movement.
Yeah, and once again, which brings us back to, and Steve, thank you very much for the point, brings us back to why, again, the Democrats should have said, Harry Reid should have said to the Republicans, okay, you want to have a filibuster on whether or not the Employee Free Choice Act is going to pass? Start talking. Tomorrow, anything goes Friday. Call in on anything you want. We'll take any topic. Plus, of course, our first hour at Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders' Brunch with Bernie, his taking your calls, as he does every Friday on the program. That and your calls here on the Tom Hartman program. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.